And I always put myself first in this, because when we see what Saint Serapion did, what he did for his neighbor, we feel like disappearing from shame. He even sold himself. He gave away everything he had, even his clothes and his copy of the gospel, and then sold himself in order to ransom a widow from captivity. He did it all for the sake of his neighbor. In other words, he put the gospel into practice perfectly. We too speak about love, saying that we love others, and so on, and I am the first to boast about it. But when I see Saint Seraphim performing these great and unimaginable deeds of sacrificial love, I have nothing more to say. I am utterly humbled, as I always say. In the Gerontikon, it is written that there was an abbot who had great love, but he was also a very spiritual man. He did not speak idle words. He was a saint, and in his prayers he would beg God not to be separated from his monks, but that wherever God placed him, there he would place his monks as well. He loved them so much that he wanted them to be together, just as they were in the cenobium, to be together also in the kingdom. Just as here they are together in a cenobium in one monastery, so in a dwelling of the Jerusalem above, they might all be together. He kept begging God, and God did receive his prayer, but God did not consent to fulfill it, because there was a difference. There was a difference in their spiritual progress, and to show him that the way he lived did not correspond to his monastic calling, God gave him the following assurance. A feast was to be held at a neighboring monastery, and, as we ourselves do, he sent his monks on ahead. He, being elderly, walked along behind, while the monks pressed on ahead, young as they were, and along the road God sent his angel in the form of a poor old man too weak to walk. He stationed him there on the road, and the monks passed by. So they said to him, "Good morning, grandfather, how are you?" And so on, "Where are you going, father?" "We are going to the feast." "To what feast?" "There, at such and such a monastery, they are celebrating," and so on. Ah, how I too would have wanted to go there. But what can I do with these legs of mine? They will not hold me up. And I have no means of getting there, nothing at all. Sadly, I will have to stay here. The father said, "What can we do for you, grandfather? We do not even have an animal for you to ride." The old man replied, "Go on, my children. You leave, and may the most holy Theotokos be with you. Have a blessed feast." And so they left. And then the abbot came along behind them. He was walking there alone when he met this man who appeared to be poor, old, and infirm. "How are you, grandfather? Are you well, elder?" And so on. "Where are you going, elder?" "I am going to the feast at such and such a monastery," and so on. "I would like to go too, but I cannot. I too would like to go there for the feast, to venerate, and so on, but my legs will not carry me." "What do you mean? They will not carry you. Let me help you," he says. "You help me too, my good old man," he says. "Go with God's blessing," he says, and so on. "Didn't the monks pass by here?" "They did." "Let me carry you." "No, we are all right." "No, I will carry you." "Go on, my dear grandfather," says my elder. "You cannot come here. I will not go to the feast unless I take you. Come, come, come here." "No, let me be, let me be." "No, I will carry you." So, look here. He helps him there. He makes the effort. He lifts him onto his back, and so on, to carry him along. Your life is not in keeping with the life of your monks. Therefore, do not ask to be in the same place as they are in heaven. And with that he vanished. And the abbot understood that this was the angel of God who had been sent in answer to his prayer. This was the answer God had to give, in his discernment and just judgment, and not the answer the elder wanted out of his love for his monks. This gives us an example, and teaches us that each person will be judged according to his deeds. Here below, we are human, and many things happen, some here, some there. Some are covered up and remain unseen. Some things are visible, while others are not. We judge according to our own judgment, each of us depending on how clear or clouded our discernment is, and so we form judgments, draw conclusions, make decisions, and pass judgment. But God will judge justly for each one of us. That is why what we must look to and say is, "Let me love, let me help, let me judge myself, let me condemn myself, and let them judge me, let them condemn me, let them not love me. What am I doing before God and before my brother?" As Saint Cosmas, the Aetolian, says, When we love God and our neighbor, we fear nothing, but we say that we must love. Of course, there are degrees, there are steps in every virtue, and especially in love. One person may be anywhere from the first step to the tenth. It is about how each one has climbed upward, for love has toil at the beginning, but afterward it is greatly needed. That is, when within myself I do not love, what happens inside me? I suffer. I suffer with my thoughts, with my imagination, with my suppositions, with anything at all. As we all know from experience, a person suffers inwardly. But if he has love, then even if the other person, his neighbor, has done him evil, even if he has killed his own mother, as we say, if he has love within him, he does not suffer. Yet when he does not have it because of a poor grasp of gospel virtue, the person only patiently endures. We see Saint Dionysios of Zakynthos, and so on. You know a little of his history, how a man killed the saint's brother and fled, running from justice and from the people, the relatives of the man he had killed. He reached the hut of Saint Dionysios and said, "This and this is what I did. I did this deed, and they are hunting me. Can you shelter me?" And so on. And the saint took him inside his hut of God. Then the people who were searching for him and pursuing him came to the saint and said, "You know, this is what happened. A man killed your brother, and we are looking for him. Have you seen him anywhere?" "No, I haven't seen anyone." "Keep looking. Perhaps you will find him, but he did not pass this way." After they had gone, the saint went to the man and said, "Man of God, what did that good man do to you?" "We were young," he explained. "The devil led me to fall into a passion, into such a spiritual and mental calamity. I did this thing, I asked forgiveness, and so on, and the saint told him that the man he had killed was his own brother, and so on. Then the man marveled at the saint's great freedom from resentment. This is love. This is God's grace made present on earth, not what we have when we say that we possess love, though in truth we have none. When a person looks at these saints, he says, 'Weep for me, my mother, if I have any love within me for my neighbor.' That is how it is. For this reason, then, we must order our life, and especially we who are monks, who supposedly came to guard the gospel, to guard it, to keep it, and to apply love in our life both within and without, because the gospel speaks of nothing else. It speaks of love. Today we heard in the reading that long-suffering and kindness are the proof of a person's love. When a person has long-suffering and goodness, these reveal that this person has love. When a person is not long-suffering, but is quick-tempered and immediately makes unreasonable demands, and when he does not extend kindness, that rich and many-sided goodness, then he is lacking in love. One deficient in love is deficient in God, for God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. So, for this reason, St. Cosmas the Aetolian speaks and tells us that there are two loves that save, and these are love toward God and love toward the neighbor. We had spoken earlier of how greatly the fathers, the monks, took care not to grieve the brother. They did everything they could to avoid causing him distress. They were willing to suffer loss themselves rather than grieve their brother, even when he was in the wrong. Even if the brother was at fault, they would not settle it in one stroke. Because of the heat, they did not travel. They did not travel by day owing to the great heat, and they kept still by day and walked by night. The elder, considering his love for the brother, that night wished himself to lead them. He had taken so much trouble along with them. Now, to correct him from above would ask for a quarrel, and so the elder pretended that he could not walk. He was exhausted. God brought the light of day. The brother realized that he had given the wrong directions. He fell at the elder's feet and said, "Forgive me, I made a mistake." "No, my child," the elder replied, "it was not your fault, it was the old man's fault again." And so, where there is love, a person is given the right words and the right way of treating others, one that helps soothe their pain, ease their hardship, and lighten their burden. And God, who searches hearts and minds, sees their good intention and sends his help. There was a brother who was struggling against carnal temptations. He would go to an elder and say, "You know, I am under attack." The elder told him to drive away the thoughts and spoke to him about the Jesus prayer. "You are growing weary and distressed. God is merciful and compassionate. He will help you. I too was once attacked, and now, as you can see, I am at peace. You too will be at peace, and so on. So the brother would go again and say, I am wearing you out, elder. No, my child, he says, it is Satan who brings the logismoi. Come, you will say the same to me. I will say the same to you, and God will do that which he must do. And after a time God saw the love of the elder and the patient endurance of the brother, and the brother's effort to keep going, to humble himself and to confess. And he took away, he says, the warfare, the carnal warfare from the brother. And we see that it is love that conquers the world and overcomes every demonic power. Why? Because this love is God. Love is God. They are one and the same, not sinful love, not love based on self-interest, not selfish love, but sincere and selfless love, the love whose ground and foundation is Christ. For Christ himself, as we know so very well, that he became man, we have not grasped this mystery. Of course, these things are revealed to the spiritual person when God opens his nose to understand the scriptures. Only then when God opens it to us, not at the level of the letter, but when he gives spirit to the letter, does the spiritual person enter into the mystery of God. We speak of God becoming man. We say that out of love, God bowed the heavens and came down, became man, became the God-man, took on flesh and lived among us. He walked, he ate, he came, he wept, he perspired, and he labored for us. All of this. But we hear all this merely as words, as theory. Yet when we enter into the Holy Spirit, when we enter into the Spirit, then the letter becomes spirit and life. It becomes a lived reality, communion with the divine, a touch from God, his very touch. And what follows from this? When we touch something, he says, we feel its effects. If it is frozen, the moment it touches us, it makes us cold. If it is warm, it warms us. So when I touch God, and he is a burning fire, a fire is kindled within you. When you touch him, and he is light, you become all light. And when you touch him, and he is love and divine longing, there is born in you love and the divine longing for God. And we see and we say that God became incarnate and became man. Yes, but can we take it in? Can we grasp it? He does not distance himself from any part of creation, and especially not from man. Even amid temptation and in hell, he is everywhere present and filling all things. He is the same one in the manger of the animals and in the embrace of the Mother of God, the same one standing before Pilate, being struck, mocked, ridiculed, scourged, and made to carry the cross, the same one climbing Golgotha, staggering from weariness and toil and from the scourging, the same one upon the cross. Yes, this is God, this is he, and it is he whom we have come to serve. How great is the shame I feel when I enter into this reality, into this theoria, this vision of God. No, I should hide myself away and become as nothing. I do not even know what to do with the shame when I think of what God has given me and how I respond to him. What does God ask of me? What does he ask? That I love him with all my heart, with all my strength and my whole being, and that I love my brother as myself. And he tells me, then you are in good standing. Is it hard labor? Is it a field he sets me to dig? Is it a field where he makes me tear out and uproot the thorns with my bare hands? No.
What does he ask of me?
Nothing. Only that you change your disposition. And I will open paradise to you. I give you my very self, and yet, if you do not do it, we come up against one another. We have our differences. We have our quarrels. We are worthy of shame and reproach because of what God asks of us, God before whom we will one day stand and be judged. And what will we say to him when he says to you, I did for you, for your soul, all this great and awesome work, coming down from the heavens? I saw your need, and I came down. I had pity on you. I had compassion on you. I sacrificed myself. And you, for me, what did you go without? Did you lack anything? In food, in drink, in clothing, in shelter? No. What did I ask of you? To love me, and you did not do it. You see, my children, how without excuse we are. And I am the first. I say this about myself. I cast a glance at something, and I saw that little passage about Saint Seraphim. No. It pinned me to the wall. It completely disarmed me. Here is the one who truly has love. the one who sells even himself. He even gave away his gospel book. He gives away all his clothes, for example. He has the gospel is in his hand all day long. If I do not keep the gospel, I am not a Christian. Yet he gives even that away as alms, then he sells himself as well. That is why Christ said that there is no greater love than for someone to give, to sacrifice himself. What Christ himself did, he also requires of us, because he has given us the strength, but our wills are not receptive to it. It is not that the sun gives no light, but we willingly shut our eyes. We close them and refuse to look. We do not want to be warmed. We do not want to be made radiant by the light of the sun. We want the darkness, and we struggle on in it. We have no guide, no compass, no pole star, nothing. So then, let us not waste our time. And always I speak first for myself. I say these things so that I too may wake up. We can do nothing without love. Let us love one another and lay aside our differences. We did not come here for that reason. We came here to make sacrifice, one for another. You will say to me, we have our personal struggles. Yes, we have them. We carry the sufferings of our own bent, and we bring them with us from the world. If we had been healthy before, we would not have needed to come here. We came here as to a doctor's office, as to a hospital. We came to be healed. We did not come to become worse. Take the example of a hospital. We all know what that is like. The patients feel compassion for one another. One has trouble with his eye, another with his leg, another with his stomach, and you see how each one sympathizes with the others. If one of them can help another, he does. He does not go up to him and say, look, you were careless, and that is why you injured your eye, nor does another say, you did not take care of your stomach, you ate what you should not have, even though you knew what would happen, and so on. No one says such things. What do they do instead? One looks upon the other with an eye of compassion. So you see, this is a hospital, how shall we put it, a human one, a hospital that offers human kindness. We see the patients have such solidarity and such love among themselves. Their pain binds them together. And we, why does the love of God not bind us? Instead we hold on to our grudges and fight and make ourselves ridiculous, as Abba Cassian says. Look, he says, the monks left the world and all the rest. They left behind great things. It is no small thing to leave the world, no small thing to leave your parents, no small thing to leave your bad habits and your freedom, where out in the world you were emperor and ruler, doing whatever you wished, going wherever you wished, eating whatever you wished, doing whatever you wished, and enjoying it. You cut all of this off, you drove all of it away from you. You left your friends and your parents, you left your studies and your youth behind, and you came here. And we monks came here, he says, only to quarrel among ourselves. The devil sets us against one another, and we fight over a needle or a pin, and so we become a laughingstock to angels, human beings and demons, and so on. And we have become a laughingstock to the whole of creation, because we, men of God, how shall I put it, with the sacrifice of the cross and the power of the resurrection, cannot manage to live in harmony at a time when we lack for nothing. Our egos begin to clash with one another, and the Apostle Paul says, if you bite one another, you will devour one another. So when one person bites another, in the end we will all be left diminished, all of us eaten away. Is this how we, the people of God, ought to behave? God forbid. We must understand this and truly believe it. Let us not play games. This is no game. We are not here to play. Time is precious. You see that at any moment we may depart this life. And where will we find ourselves then? It is enough to make a person rack his brain. Man of God, since your life is not in your own hands, what are you fighting over? If God takes you at this very moment, what will you say? Here you may talk foolishly, and yet, yes, that is how you speak here. And here you see some worldly people who believe in nothing because they say that there is nothing beyond this life. But when that hour comes, and he sees that none of this was a lie, that the gospel was true, and that eternal life exists, and when he sees before him the demons dragging him away, then he will come to his senses. Then, of course, the shadow of the law will fall away. The merely human part will fall away, that human sack, so to speak, that shuts the soul inside and will not release it. It will not let the soul work because of its passion, will not let it function rightly, will not let it see the truth, The soul departs from the body and comes into its natural life, and at once, not that it merely receives, but it comes to have not 400 minds, but billions of minds in that hour. But the bird has already flown. The feast is over. The door has closed, and he has been left outside. So run now. But afterward come remorse, and all the rest. That is not how things should be. We must become aware of reality and the truth, lay everything out on the table, examine it carefully, and ask ourselves, where am I going? What am I doing? Tomorrow I will depart this life and stand before God. Sooner or later, there will be a voice that, as the saying goes, will pin us to the wall, and we will have no answer, no way to object or say, no, I did not do that, or no, that is not how I did it. You did not do it that way? You did it. We see this in the account of the martyrdom of the saints, the five holy martyrs, Eustrasios and the others, including Mardarios. There was a man who had a vision while reading their martyrdom. As he read the epistle and the account of what they suffered, he lost his courage. When he saw the red-hot gridiron, it says he became afraid. Yes? How did he put it? Did he smile? No. Saint Eustrasios says to him, when you went through it, did you lose your courage? Tell me the truth. Yes, what I want to say is that there the conscience cannot tell us things falsely. Here and now we muffle it, because the black one too is trying to tangle it up, to get his own way, to set us on the crooked road. But when the conscience is no longer restrained, it will speak out with perfect clarity about what happened, how the person committed the sin, how he acted, and how he kept the commandments or failed to keep them. And then who will be found innocent? No one. Scripture says, all the righteousness of man is like a filthy rag before God. All man's righteousness, all his virtue, is like a dirty rag. Well then, what will his wickedness and savagery be like? It will be a cesspit, nothing but a cesspit. May God forbid it. So, my children, let us take heed. And I first of all who am saying these things, let us understand that this is no game. Let us face these things squarely, and bear one another's burdens. We all have our faults, not one of us is without them. They begin with me, and extend all the way to the newest novice. We are all of us full of flaws and infirmity. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. We cannot fulfill, cannot carry out the law of God, unless we endure one another. We are weak. We must sympathize. I am afflicted in the eye, another in the kidney. So what must we do? Each one is to help the other, not for me to say, you know, this one is such and such, but you two are something else. So do not open your mouth, because you are not sinless. When the Jews say the scribes and the Pharisees caught that woman, caught in adultery, they bring her to Christ and say, we caught her in the very act, and the law says she is to be stoned. What do you say? Christ bent down and began writing. Then he said, let the one among you who is without sin be the first to cast a stone at her. And because their consciences told them, I am not without sin, one by one they dropped their stones and went away. And when our dear Christ raised his head and looked at her, he said, has no one condemned you? No one, Lord. Neither do I condemn you. Go and do not sin again. He was the judge, and yet he said, I do not condemn you. So then, since this is how it is, the stone of anathema, the stone of the curse, we cannot hurl it wherever we please. Let us not throw it. Are we saying that our Christ may be at fault? No. But did Christ not say once again that, and the Apostle Paul too, and all the fathers, they all speak of love and of patient endurance? Who are you to judge your superior, or anyone else? Who are you? He has someone to judge him. There is a judge. He knows how to hammer one into shape, and how to uphold another who is about to fall. Who are you? Have compassion on your brother. Christ says, if you love those who love you, what grace is there in that? Even sinners do the same. And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? If you do only what sinners and tax collectors also do, what is exceptional about that? But I say to you, love your enemies, do good to those who mistreat you, and do not retaliate against those who persecute you. If someone asks for your tunic, give him your cloak as well. If someone compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. What does this mean? Christ is asking us for a spiritual labor that goes beyond reason, beyond human justice, beyond the law of men. We must rise above all that. We must live on a higher plane. When they strike you on one cheek, turn the other as well. Human reasoning will say, what, am I a fool to let him hit me? And then it says, he struck me once, so I will strike him back. That is human logic and human justice. But what does God's justice say? Turn the other cheek and let him strike you there as well. So what does this mean? It means that you must go further, because you have the strength to do so. I have already done it. Myself, says Christ. I was at fault in nothing. They slapped me too. They insulted me. They beat him here. They beat him there. They took our Christ, bound him to the pillar, and scourged him naked. He bore it. He did not resist. He did not resist, and God repaid it in full. So we have no excuse, none whatsoever, to put ourselves forward and to judge any situation, whatever it may be, within the life of our house. We are human. I know we make mistakes, so let us practice patient endurance. Do we not have a little faith in God? Let us have it. Be long-suffering. You are being too rigid. Be patient. Be kind. Become a little useful. A person of the Holy Spirit. A little more open. A little more gentle. And it must be so from both sides. These things are not one-sided. They must be mutual. We all need to take this matter to heart. And I, first of all, I must humble myself and bend down even lower than you and show you by my own example. That is how it must be. Remember the two brothers, one on one side and one on the other. One of them thought and said, why should my brother come to fetch the rusk? Let me take it to him myself. He even soaked it and set off. And the other from his side said, why should my brother wear himself out bringing it to me when it is better that I go and get it? And they meet on the road, and one says, brother, why do you wear yourself out coming to bring me the rusk when I was on my way to you? Paradise has room for you alone, and not for us, and so we make our stubborn stand. Well, then they hear a voice that says, this contention of yours has risen up to God like incense. You see, my children, this is a holy contention. Whereas if the quarrel were over something else, it would be on the side of the devil, it would be for the devil, but as it was for God. So it is the same thing, yet the outcome is different. The outcome is different. For this reason, brother with brother, unless you sacrifice your own will to do the will of your brother, you will offer nothing at all to the other. What does deny yourself mean? It means denying your own little desires. For a brother living in a cenobitic monastery, of course, cenobitic monasteries are places of training, spiritual gymnasiums. There, each person has his own inner world, and it is there that you will learn how to endure and how to bear the burden. There you will learn whether you have patience, whether you have love, whether you harbor hatred or hostility, whether you condemn others or refrain from condemning them. You will learn all this there, in the cenobitic monastery, because there you will be put under pressure, and what is within you will come spilling out. But when you are alone, living quietly in stillness, no one asks anything of you, no one scrutinizes you, and you do not encounter some greater or different evil in another person that will test whether you judge him or not. You will not see a virtuous person, and by comparison, recognize your own impoverished state and come to blame yourself. So it is within the community that we are needed and shaped. It may seem like a jumble of temptations, and this problem and that, but perhaps the good monk understands what is happening. Little by little, as we say, he is being shaped well. The rough edges he has are gradually cut away and hewn down, like those beautiful stones, those pebbles on the seashore. How lovely they are! You can walk over them even barefoot and hold them in your hand, all in different colors and sizes, round, beautiful, and smooth. But they were not always so. These were stones like all the stones on the mountain, jagged and sharp and the rest. When these stones fell into the sea, with the waves, with the storms, the wave coming and going, one stone rubbing against another, against the sea, against the next, and so on. They end up washing out onto the shore as that beautiful pebble which you see and rejoice in. You pick it up, you delight in it and enjoy its beauty. But it was not so before. Who made them this way? The storms and the grinding of one against another. So, it is inside the cenobium too. We are stirred together, yes. One this way, another that. One who shouts at everyone down the line, another who runs off elsewhere. So if it causes offense, Our stumblings that happen and all these things that happen are not off the point. They are within the very matter of our cultivation, of our perfecting. For we all came jagged like stones from the mountains, sharpened in our pride by our delusions, by our arrogance, by what we inherited, by our prejudices, by the self-indulgences we have practiced, by our fantasies and a thousand other things. We came here, Christ brought us here, and inside the monastery we are ground against one another, and little by little, with the passing of time, with the long suffering that we speak of, for the sake of kindness, we come later, let us say at a greater age, to feel ourselves different, to feel that I can bear even this, I can love even this one, I can overlook even that. This, whereas before all these things constantly troubled me, now they no longer trouble me, now I see them from above. And why? Because that work was done. Those trials, those upheavals came, and the lumps began to fall away. They were cut off and cast off, and the person is set free, and afterwards he shows himself a real man, and feels the beauty, he sees it in prayer, he sees it in his soul. He sees how he looks upon people, how he understands them, and so many other things which each one who has personal experience of them knows. But if, first of all, there was Antony, who was a hermit. He was living in a cave, not Saint Antony the Great, but the later, lesser known Saint Antony. And as the elder relates, he heard, or rather read, a passage from Saint John of the Ladder. At one point it says, "He who dwells in stillness, having recognized his own weakness, and trained himself through obedience to another, has effortlessly lifted his gaze to Christ. The one who dwells in stillness, the hesychast, recognized his own weakness. He understood that he was spiritually ill, that something was wrong, and that he was not being trained, was not being tested. But under whom would he be trained? So he sold himself into obedience. He gave his whole self over to obedience. And there, where he was blind and thought it a marvel, he rose up into discernment." The Cenobia are schools of training, and when a person has been trained within the Cenobium, as we see in the Fathers, and reaches a good state, and excels in obedience, excels in giving rest to his elder, and God grants a revelation that he must go and live in stillness, he takes the blessing and goes and lives in Hesychia. And so he goes on to study at the university, but only after passing through middle school and high school, he begins with the foundations, and from there he moves on to the higher subjects. The skills he needed, how to write essays, structure his work, and so forth, he learned by the end of high school. From that point onward, he takes up the more advanced subjects. And so we come now to the Cenobitic monastery. The superior trains you as though you were in high school, and when someone here receives his diploma with good marks, he can sit the entrance examinations and go on to university. So he comes to the monastery. That is why, as we have always seen, there were people who left the monastery and went away to live in stillness, but they had excelled, they had earned the highest marks. By their way of life, they gave their abbots full assurance concerning them, and the abbot also received assurance from God that he should allow such a monk to go and live in stillness. So he gives him his blessing, and the monk goes away to live in stillness, and so forth. There was, for example, a monk from Dionysiu Monastery. In fact, the story begins by saying that Elder Daniel left Dionysiu and went into the wilderness, because he had left without a blessing, and so on he would see a lion there coming to devour him. So they advised him to return and receive his elder's blessing, because that was precisely what he had failed to obtain. So he returned to Dionysiu Monastery and received his elder's blessing. Then he went back into solitude. Up there, the lion was nowhere to be seen. There was nothing at all. His elder's blessing had protected him. These are the miracles that monks today fail to heed. They scatter here and there and pay no regard to their elders, yet everything has its proper order. Everything has its proper place. Whatever word the elder may speak, whether it seems wrong or good, that is how the matter will unfold. So, they know that if you have brought peace to your elder, you have brought peace to God. If you have not brought peace to your elder, neither have you brought peace to God. Those who said these things know these lessons well. But as for us today, we are airy and light, so to speak. The wind blows, whoosh, and off we go. So where do we go? Wherever the wind of self-will and self-indulgence carries us. But when a person has that repose, and has these things, and has his elder's blessing, then he goes lawfully and rightly. and he is sheltered. What I mean is that today the understanding of the elder, the spiritual father, has become blurred and diminished. People think of him merely as the one in charge, as a superior, but that is not what he is. He is the spiritual father. He is the representative, the one through whom grace flows, call him what you will. He is like a fountain. In any case, he holds this place of the spiritual father, and God is the one who enlightens him, who guides him, and he is the one who will say, that is right, that is not right. That is exactly why we must hold on to this, because as for our own elders, and I am passing this on to you as well, so that it continues in the succession, these are the things we heard from our own fathers before us. It is not some disorderly thing, the way people go off and park themselves here and there and so on. Rather, they were well ordered. That is exactly why we must keep this sense of our elder and not do disorderly things and self-willed things which never prosper. But when we have our elder's prayer, protection, and blessing, we go forward under that protection. So, despite being unprepared, these are the few brief words I wanted to share with you tonight. I never prepare for something like this, and because people were calling me right up to the last moment, please forgive me for not feeding you well. These few words are what God has given us. May He bless them as He blessed the 5 loaves in the wilderness, so that your souls may be filled, and this food may give you strength and encouragement, enabling us to overcome our weaknesses and become people of God, people of the gospel, that is, true monks. Because when you see a monk, you ought to think that this person differs from other people. The fact that he wears the black, that he wears the cassock, that he is called a Levite, that he is called a man of God, means that he also keeps the things of God. We speak about love, and I am the first to do so, but I do not live this love. He put him on his shoulder, and at first, of course, his weight felt natural. Little by little, however, the abbot felt the burden growing lighter and lighter. Then, in the end, he felt nothing at all, and he heard the man he had been carrying speak to him as he flew up into heaven. "Have you realized," he said, "that your life does not accord with the life?" Once and for all, so to speak, prodding him and reproving him in ways that would wound him, aggravating by every means the wound he already carried within himself as someone who had done wrong. Do you remember the passage in the Sayings of the Fathers about a brother who was serving as a guide? They traveled by night. Since it was dark, no one could see very well, and the brother who was guiding the fathers took the wrong path. The fathers said to the elder, without telling the guide, "Giranta, the brother is not leading us the right way. We have taken the wrong path. Do not say anything to him," the elder replied, "or we will hurt him. Instead, I will pretend that I am tired and cannot walk any farther. We will stay here until daybreak. Then the brother will see where we are, realize his mistake, and we will spare his feelings." Can we grasp with the nous, the spiritual intellect, and explain how he is both upon the throne and in the embrace of the most holy Theotokos, how from there he is everywhere present and fills all things, how he is the same one in the manger, upon the throne, within the universe and beyond the universe, and how he remains undivided and inseparable? "I came down and did so much on earth for you. What need did I have to do any of it? I lack nothing. I am in need of nothing. It was for you that I lived." We struggle and fight like wild beasts in the darkness, saying, "This is to blame, that is to blame, and something else is to blame." But neither the window nor the wall nor the table that crashes against your head and hands is to blame. The fault is that you do not want to step outside this enclosure, look upon the light, and become a son of light yourself. This, then, is our gospel, our beloved gospel, which should be most dear and cherished by us. For without it, without this compass, we cannot walk, just as a ship cannot sail without a compass, and without keeping its eye on the pole that shows it precisely how to find its bearings, where to turn the rudder and point the bow. It cannot sail. If we do not have the gospel in our hands, we have nothing. They would, of course, tell us many stories about hermits of the Holy Mountain and others. Elder Joseph, as I have told you before, had a great love for our cenobitic communities. In fact, he would single out 3 or 4 of our communities by name. When monks from a cenobitic monastery came to disclose their thoughts to the elder, he received them with a special warmth. He always treated them with honor because he loved the cenobitic life, for it is a well-ordered way of life,